couple of days. He checked in with Harry Rex, who was at the office where he usually spent the weekends. With four wives under his belt, there were good reasons he wasn't home much. "Do you recall the judge hearing a case on the coast early last year?" Ray asked. Harry Rex was eating something and smacking into the phone. "The coast?" He hated the coast, thought they were all a bunch of redneck mafia types. "He was paid for a trial down there January of last year." "He was sick last year," Harry Rex said, then swallowed something liquid. "His cancer was diagnosed last July." "I don't remember any case on the coast," he said, and bit into something else.
"That surprises me."
"Me too."
"Why are you going through his files?"
"I'm just checking his payroll records against his trial files."
"Why?"
"Because I'm the executor."
"Forgive me. When are you coming back?"
"Couple of days."
"Hey, I bumped into Claudia today. Hadn't seen her in months. And she gets to town early, parks a brand new black Cadillac near the coffee shop so everybody can see it. Then spends half the morning piddling around town. What a piece of work."
Ray couldn't help but smile at the thought of Claudia racing down to the car dealership with a pocket full of cash. The judge would be proud. Sleep came in short naps on the sofa. The walls cracked louder. The vents and ducts seemed more active. Things moved, then they didn't. The night after the break-in, the entire apartment was poised for another one. Chapter 27. Trying hard to be normal, Ray took a long jog on a favorite trail, along the downtown mall, down Main Street to the campus, up Observatory Hill and back, 6 miles in all. He had lunch with Carl Merck at Bizou, a popular bistro 3 blocks from his apartment, and he drank coffee afterward at a sidewalk cafe. Fogg had the Bonanza reserved for a 3 p.m. training session. But the mail came, and everything normal went out the window. The envelope was addressed to him by hand, nothing on the return, with a postmark in Charlottesville the day before. A stick of dynamite would not have looked more suspicious lying there on the table. Inside was a letter-sized sheet of paper, tri-folded, and when he spread it open, all systems shut down. For a moment he couldn't think, breathe, feel, hear. It was a color digital photo of the front of 14B at Cheney's, printed off a computer on regular copier paper. No words, no warnings, no threats. None were needed. When he could breathe again, he also started sweating, and the numbness wore off enough for a sharp pain to knife through his stomach. He was dizzy, so he closed his eyes, and when he opened them and looked at the picture again, it was shaking. His first thought, the first he could remember, was that there was nothing in the apartment he could not do without. He could leave everything, but he filled a small bag anyway. 3 hours later, he stopped for gas in Roanoke, and 3 hours after that, he pulled into a busy truck stop just east of Knoxville. He sat in the parking lot for a long time, low in his TT Roadster, watching the truckers come and go, watching the movements in and out of the crowded cafe. There was a table he wanted in the window, and when it was available, he locked the Audi and went inside. From the table he guarded his car, 50 feet away, and stuffed with $3 million in cash. Because of the aroma, he guessed that grease was the cafe's specialty. He ordered a burger and on a napkin began scribbling his options. The safest place for the money was in a bank, in a large lockbox behind thick walls, cameras, etc. He could divide the money, scatter it among several banks in several towns between Charlottesville and Clanton, and leave a complicated trail. The money could be discreetly hauled in by briefcase. Once locked away, it would be safe forever. The trail, though, would be extensive. Lease forms, proper ID, home address, phones. Here, meet our new vice president, in business with strangers, video cameras, lockbox registers, and who knew what else, because Ray had never hidden stuff in a bank before.
He had passed several self-storage places along the interstate. They were everywhere these days, and for some reason wedged as close to the main roads as possible. Why not pick one at random, pull over, pay cash, and keep the paperwork to a minimum? He could hang around in Podunk Town for a day or two, find some more fireproof boxes at a local supply house, secure his money, then sneak away. It was a brilliant idea, because his tormentor would not expect it. And it was a stupid idea, because he would leave the money. He could take it home to Maple Run and bury it in the basement. Harry Rex could alert the sheriff and the police to watch for suspicious outsiders lurking around the town. If an agent showed up to follow him, he'd get nailed in Clanton, and Dell at the coffee shop would have the details by sunrise. You couldn't cough there without three people catching your cold. The truckers came in waves, most of them talking loudly as they entered, anxious to mix it up after miles of solitary confinement. They all looked the same, jeans and pointed-toe boots. A pair of sneakers walked by and caught Ray's attention. Khakis, not jeans. The man was alone and took a seat at the counter. In the mirror, Ray saw his face, and it was one he had seen before. Wide through the eyes, narrow at the chin, long flat nose, flaxen hair, 35 years old, give or take. Somewhere around Charlottesville, but impossible to place. Or was everyone now a suspect? Run with your loot like a murderer with his victim in the trunk, and plenty of faces look familiar and ominous. The burger arrived, hot and steaming, covered with fries, but he had lost his appetite. He started on his third napkin. The first two had taken him nowhere. His options at the moment were limited. Since he was unwilling to let the money out of his sight, he would drive all night, stopping for coffee, perhaps pulling over for a nap, and arrive at Clanton early in the morning. Once he was on his turf again, things would become clearer. Hiding the money in the basement was a bad idea. An electrical short, a bolt of lightning, a stray match, and the house was gone. It was hardly more than kindling, anyway. The man at the counter had yet to look at Ray, and the more Ray looked at him, the more convinced he was that he was wrong. It was a generic face, the kind you see every day and seldom remember. He was eating chocolate pie and drinking coffee. Odd, at 11 o'clock at night. He rolled into Clanton just after 7 a.m. He was red-eyed, ragged with exhaustion, in need of a shower and 2 days' rest. Through the night, while he wasn't watching every set of headlights behind him and slapping himself to stay awake, he had dreamed of the solitude of Maple Run, a large, empty house all to himself. He could sleep upstairs, downstairs, on the porch. No ringing phones, no one to bother him. But the roofers had other plans. They were hard at work when he arrived, their trucks and ladders and tools covering the front lawn and blocking the driveway. He found Harry Rex at the coffee shop, eating poached eggs and reading two newspapers at once. "What are you doing here?" he said, barely looking up. He wasn't finished with his eggs or his papers, and didn't appear too excited to see Ray. "Maybe I'm hungry."
"You look like hell."
"Thanks. I couldn't sleep there, so I drove here."
"You're cracking up."
"Yes, I am." He finally lowered the newspaper and stabbed an egg that appeared to be covered with hot sauce.
"You drove all night from Charlottesville?"
"It's only 15 hours. A waitress brought him coffee. "How long are those roofers planning on working?"
"They're there?"
"Oh, yes. At least a dozen of them. I wanted to sleep for the next 2 days."
"It's those Atkins boys. They're fast, unless they start drinking and fighting. Had one fall off a ladder last year, broke his neck. Got him $30,000 in workers' comp."
"Anyway, why then did you hire them?"
"They're cheap. Same as you, Mr. Executor. Go sleep in my office. I got a hideaway on the third floor."
"With a bed?" Harry Rex glanced around as if the gossip mongers of Clanton were closing in.
"Remember Rosetta Rhines?"
"No." She was my fifth secretary and third wife. That was where it all started.
Are the sheets clean?
What sheets? Take it or leave it. It's very quiet, but the floor shakes. That's how we got caught.
Sorry I asked. Ray took a long swig of coffee. He was hungry, but not ready for a feast. He wanted a bowl of flakes with skim milk and fruit, something sensible. But he'd be ridiculed for ordering such light fare in the coffee shop.
You gonna eat? Harry Rex growled at him.
No. We need to store some stuff. All those boxes and furniture. You know a place?
We?
Okay, I need a place.
It's nothing but crap.
A bite of a biscuit, one loaded with sausage, cheddar, and what appeared to be mustard.
Burn it. I can't burn it,
at least not now.
Then do what all good executors do. Store for 2 years, then give it to the Salvation Army and burn what they don't want.
Yes or no, is there a storage place in town?
Didn't you go to school with that crazy Cantrell boy?
There were two of them.
No, there were three of them. One got hit by that greyhound out near Toby Town.
A long pull of coffee, then more eggs.
A storage place, Harry Rex? Testy, aren't we?
No, sleep-deprived.
I've offered my love nest.
No thanks. I'll try my luck with the Rufus.
Their uncle is Virgil Cantrell. I handled his first wife's second divorce, and he's converted the old depot into a storage warehouse.
Is that the only place in town?
No. Lundy Staggs put in some of those mini storage units west of town, but they got flooded. I wouldn't go there.
What's the name of this depot? Ray asked, tired of the coffee shop.
The depot.
Another bite of biscuit.
By the railroad tracks? That's it.
He began shaking a bottle of Tabasco sauce over the remaining pile of eggs.
He's usually got some space. I even put in a block room for fire protection. Don't go in the basement, though.
Ray hesitated, knowing he should ignore the bait. He glanced at his car parked in front of the courthouse and finally said,
"Why not?" "He keeps his boy down there."
"His boy?"
"Yeah, he's crazy, too. Virgil couldn't get him in Whitfield and couldn't afford a private joint, so he figured he'd just lock him up in the basement."
"You serious?"
"Hell yes, I'm serious. I told him it wasn't against the law. Boy's got everything. Bedroom, bathroom, television. Hell of a lot cheaper than paying rent in a nut house."
What's his name? Ray asked, digging the hole deeper.
"Little Virgil."
"Little Virgil."
"Little Virgil."
"How old is little Virgil?"
"I don't know. 45, 50.
To Ray's great relief, no Virgil was present when he walked into the depot. A stocky woman in overalls said Mr. Cantrell was out running errands and wouldn't be back for 2 hours. Ray inquired about storage space, and she offered to show him around. Years before, a remote uncle from Texas had come to visit. Ray's mother scrubbed and polished him to the point of misery. With great anticipation, they drove to the depot to fetch the uncle. Forrest was an infant, and they left him at home with the nanny. Ray clearly remembered waiting on the platform, hearing the train's whistle, seeing it approach, feeling the excitement as the crowd waited. The depot back then was a busy place. When he was in high school, they boarded it up, and the hoodlums used it as a hangout. It was almost razed before the town stepped in with an ill-advised renovation. Now it was a collection of chopped-up rooms flung over two floors, with worthless junk piled to the ceiling. Lumber and wallboard were stacked throughout, evidence of endless repairs. Sawdust covered the floors. A quick walkthrough convinced Ray that the place was more flammable than Maple Run.
"We got more space in the basement," the woman said.
"No thanks." He stepped outside to leave, and flying by on Taylor Street was a brand-new black Cadillac, glistening in the early sun. Not a speck of dirt anywhere. Claudia behind the wheel with Jackie O sunglasses. Standing there in the early morning heat, watching the car race down the street, Ray felt the town of Clanton collapse on top of him. Claudia, the Virgils, Harry Rex and his wives and secretaries,
the Atkins boys roofing and drinking and fighting. Is everybody crazy, or is it just me? He got in his car and left the depot, slinging gravel behind. At the edge of town, the road stopped. To the north was forest. To the south was the coast. Life would get no simpler by visiting his brother. But he had promised. Chapter 28. 2 days later, Ray arrived on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. There were friends from his law school days at Tulane he wanted to see, and he gave serious thought to spending time in his old haunts. He craved an oyster po' boy from Frankie and Johnny's by the levee, a muffaletta from Maspero's on Decatur in the Quarter, a Dixie beer at the Chart Room on Bourbon Street, and chicory coffee and beignets at Café du Monde. All of his old haunts from 20 years ago. But crime was rampant in New Orleans, and his handsome little sports car could be a target. Lucky the thief who stole it and yanked open the trunk. Thieves would not catch him, nor would state troopers, because he kept precisely at the posted limits. He was a perfect driver, obeying all the laws, closely eyeing every other car. The traffic slowed him on Highway 90, and for an hour he crept eastward through Long Beach, Gulfport, and Biloxi, hugging the beach, past the shiny new casinos sitting at the water, past new hotels and restaurants. Gambling had hit the coast, as fast as it had arrived in the farmlands around Tunica. He crossed the Bay of Biloxi and entered Jackson County. Near Pascagoula, he saw a flashing rented sign, beckoning travelers to stop in for all-you-can-eat Cajun, just $13.99. It was a dive, but the parking lot was well lit. He cased it first, and realized he could sit at a table in the window and keep an eye on his car. This had become his habit. There were three counties along the Gulf, Jackson on the east and bordering Alabama, Harrison in the middle, and Hancock on the west next to Louisiana. A local politician had succeeded nicely in Washington and kept the pork flowing back to the shipyards in Jackson County. Gambling was paying the bills and building the schools in Harrison County, and it was Hancock, the least developed and populated, that Judge Attlee had visited in January 1999 for a case that no one back home knew about. After a slow dinner of crawfish étouffée and shrimp remoulade, with some raw oysters thrown in, he drifted back across the bay, back through Biloxi and Gulfport. In the town of Passe Christian, he found what he was searching for, a new flat motel with doors that opened to the outside. The surroundings looked safe. The parking lot was half full. He paid $60 cash for one night and backed the car as close to his door as possible. He had changed his mind about being without a weapon. One strange sound during the night, and he'd be outside in a flash with the judge's .38 loaded now. He was perfectly prepared to sleep in the car if necessary. Hancock County was named for John, he of the bold signature on the Declaration of Independence. Its courthouse was built in 1911 in the center of Bay St. Louis, and was practically blown away by Hurricane Camille in August 1969. The eye ran right through Passe Christian and Bay St. Louis, and no building escaped severe damage. More than 100 people died, and many were never found. Ray stopped to read a historical marker on the courthouse lawn, then turned once more to look at his little Audi. Though court records were usually open, he was nervous anyway. The clerks in Clanton guarded their records and monitored who came and went. He wasn't sure what he was looking for or where to begin. The biggest fear, however, was what he might find. In the chancery clerk's office, he loitered just long enough to catch the eye of a pretty young lady with a pencil in her hair. "May I help you?" she drawled. He was holding a legal pad as if that would somehow qualify him and open all the right doors. "Do y'all keep records of trials?" he asked, trying hard to string out the "y'all" and overemphasizing it in the process. She frowned and looked at him as if he had committed a misdemeanor. We have minutes from each term of court, she said slowly, because he obviously was not very bright. And we have the actual court files. Ray was scribbling this down. And, she said after a pause, there are the trial transcripts taken down by the court reporter, but we don't keep those here.
Can I see the minutes? He asked, grasping at the first item she had mentioned.
Sure. Which term?
January of last year. She took two steps to her right and began pecking on a keyboard. Ray looked around the large office where several ladies were at their desks, some typing, some filing, some on the phone. The last time he'd seen the Chancery Clerk's office in Clanton, there had been only one computer. Hancock County was 10 years ahead. In a corner, two lawyers sipped coffee from paper cups and whispered low about important matters. Before them were the property deed books that dated back 200 years. Both had reading glasses perched on their noses and scuffed wingtips and ties with thick knots. They were checking land titles for $100 a pop, one of a dozen dreary chores handled by legions of small-town lawyers. One of them noticed Ray and eyed him suspiciously. That could be me, Ray thought to himself. The young lady ducked and pulled out a large ledger filled with computer printouts. She flipped pages, then stopped and spun it around on the counter.
Here, she said, pointing again. January 99, 2 weeks of court. Here's the docket, which goes on for several pages. This column lists the final disposition. As you'll see, most cases were continued to the March term.
Ray was looking and listening.
Any case in particular? She asked.
Do you remember a case that was heard by Judge Attlee from Ford County? I think he was here as a special chancellor, he asked casually.
She glared at him as if he had asked to see her own divorce file.
Are you a reporter? She asked,
and Ray almost took a step backward.
Do I need to be? He asked.
Two of the other deputy clerks had stopped whatever they were doing and were frowning at him. She forced a smile.
No, but that case was pretty big. It's right here, she said, pointing.
On the docket, it was listed simply as Gibson versus Meyer Brack. Ray nodded approvingly, as if he had found exactly what he wanted.
And where would the file be located, he asked.
It's thick, she said.
He followed her into a room filled with black metal cabinets that held thousands of files. She knew exactly where to go.
Sign here, she said, handing over a clipboard with a ledger on it. Just your name, the date, I'll do the rest.
What kind of case was it? He asked as he filled in the blanks.
Wrongful death.
She opened a long drawer and pointed from one end to the other.
All this, she said. The pleadings start here, then discovery, then the trial transcript. You can take it to that table over there, but it cannot leave the room. Judge's orders.
Which judge?
Judge Attlee.
He died, you know.
Walking away, she said,
That's not such a bad thing.
The air in the room went with her, and it took a few seconds for Ray to think again. The file was 4 feet thick, but he didn't care. He had the rest of the summer. Cleet Gibson died in 1997 at the age of 61. Cause of death, kidney failure. Cause of kidney failure, a drug called Ryax, manufactured by Meyer Brack, according to the allegations of the lawsuit, and found to be true by the Honorable Reuben V. Attlee, sitting as special chancellor. Mr. Gibson had taken Ryax for 8 years to battle high cholesterol. The drug was prescribed by his doctor and sold by his pharmacist, both of whom were also sued by his widow and children. After taking the drug for about 5 years, he began having kidney problems, which were treated by a different set of doctors. At the time, Ryax, a relatively new drug, had no known side effects. When Gibson's kidneys quit completely, he somehow came to know a Mr. Patton French, attorney at law. This happened shortly before his death.
Patton French was with French and French over in Biloxi. A firm letterhead listed six other lawyers. In addition to the manufacturer, physician, and pharmacist, the defendants also included a local drug salesman and his brokerage company out of New Orleans. Every defendant had a big firm engaged, including some heavyweights from New York. The litigation was contentious, complicated, even fierce at times, and Mr. Patton French and his little firm from Biloxi waged an impressive war against the giants on the other side. Meyer Brack was a Swiss pharmaceutical giant, privately owned, with interests in 60 countries, according to the deposition of its American representative. In 1998, its profits were $635 million on revenues of $9.1 billion. That one deposition took an hour to read. For some reason, Patton French decided to file a wrongful death suit in Chancery Court, the Court of Equity, instead of Circuit Court, where most trials were by jury. By statute, the only jury trials in Chancery were for will contests. Ray had sat through several of those miserable affairs while clerking for the judge. Chancery Court had jurisdiction for two reasons. First, Gibson was dead, and his estate was a chancery matter. Second, he had a child under the age of 18. The legal business of minors belonged in Chancery Court. Gibson also had three children who were not minors. The lawsuit could have been filed in either circuit or chancery, one of 100 great quirks in Mississippi law. Ray had once asked the judge to explain this enigma, and as usual, the answer was simply, "We have the greatest court system in the country." Every old chancellor believed this. Giving lawyers the choice of where to sue was not peculiar to any state. Forum shopping was a game played on the national map. But when a lawsuit by a widow living in rural Mississippi against a mammoth Swiss company that created a drug produced in Uruguay was filed in the Chancery Court of Hancock County, a red flag was raised. The federal courts were in place to deal with such far-flung disputes, and Meyer Brack and its phalanx of lawyers tried gallantly to remove the case. Judge Attlee held firm, as did the federal judge. Local defendants were included, thus removal to federal court could be denied. Reuben Attlee was in charge of the case, and as he pushed the matter to trial, his patience with the defense lawyers wore thin. Ray had to smile at some of his father's rulings. They were terse, brutally to the point, and designed to light a fire under the hordes of lawyers scrambling around the defendants. The modern-day rules about speedy trials had never been necessary in Judge Attlee's courtroom. It became evident that Ryax was a bad product. Patton French found two experts who blasted the drug, and the experts defending it were nothing but mouthpieces for the company. Ryax lowered cholesterol to amazing levels. It had been rushed through the approvals, then dumped into the marketplace where it became extremely popular. Tens of thousands of kidneys had now been ruined, and Mr. Patton French had Meyer Brack pinned to the mat. The trial lasted for 8 days. Against the objections of the defense, the proceedings began each morning precisely at 8:15, and they often ran until 8 at night, prompting more objections, which Judge Attlee ignored. Ray had seen this many times. The judge believed in hard work, and with no jury to pamper, he was brutal. His final decision was dated 2 days after the last witness testified, a shocking blow for judicial promptness. Evidently, he had remained in Bay St. Louis and dictated a 4-page ruling to the court reporter. This, too, did not surprise Ray. The judge loathed procrastination in deciding cases. Plus, he had his notes to rely on. For 8 days of nonstop testimony, the judge must have filled 30 legal pads. His ruling had enough detail to impress the experts. The family of Cleet Gibson was awarded $1.1 million in actual damages, the value of his life, according to an economist. And to punish Meyer Brack for pushing such a bad product, the judge awarded $10 million in punitive damages. The opinion was a scathing indictment of corporate recklessness and greed, and it was quite obvious that Judge Attlee had become deeply troubled
by the practices of Meyer Brack. Even so, Ray had never known his father to resort to punitive damages. There was the usual flurry of post-trial motions, all of which the judge dismissed with brusque paragraphs. Meyer Brack wanted the punitive damages taken out. Patton French wanted them increased. Both sides received a written tongue-lashing. Oddly, there was no appeal. Ray kept waiting for one. He flipped through the post-trial section twice, then dug through the entire drawer again. It was possible the case had been settled afterward, and he made a note to ask the clerk. A nasty little fight erupted over the fees. Patton French had a contract signed by the Gibson family that gave him 50% of any recovery. The judge, as always, felt that was excessive. In Chancery, the fees were within the sole discretion of the judge. 33% had always been his limit. The math was easy to do, and Mr. French fought hard to collect his well-earned money. His honor didn't budge. The Gibson trial was Judge Attlee at his finest, and Ray felt both proud and sentimental. It was difficult to believe it had taken place almost a year and a half earlier, when the judge was suffering from diabetes, heart disease, and probably cancer, though the latter was 6 months from being discovered. He admired the old warrior. With the exception of one lady who was eating a melon at her desk and doing something else online, the clerks were off at lunch. Ray left the place and went to find a library. Chapter 29. From a burger joint in Biloxi, he checked his voicemail in Charlottesville and found three messages. Kaylee called to say she'd like to have dinner. A quick discard took care of her, forever. Fog Newton called to say the bonanza was clear for the next week, and they needed to go fly. And Martin Gage with the IRS in Atlanta checked in, still looking for the facts of the bogus letter. Keep looking, Ray thought to himself. He was eating a prepackaged salad at a bright orange plastic table across the highway from the beach. He could not remember the last time he had sat alone in a fast food joint, and he was doing so now only because he could eat with his car close by and in plain sight. Plus the place was crawling with young mothers and their children, usually a low-crime group. He finally gave up on the salad and called Fogg. The Biloxi Public Library was on Lemieux Street. Using a new map he'd purchased at a convenience store, he found it and parked in a row of cars near the main entrance. As was his habit now, he stopped and observed his car and all the elements around it before entering the building. The computers were on the first floor, in a room encased in glass, but with no windows to the outside, to his disappointment. The leading newspaper on the coast was the Sun Herald, and through a news library service, its archives could be searched back to 1994. He went to January 24, 1999, the day after Judge Attlee had issued his ruling in the trial. Not surprisingly, there was a story on the front page of the Metro section about the $11.1 million verdict over in Bay St. Louis, and it was certainly no surprise to see that Mr. Patton French had a lot to say. Judge Attlee refused comment. The defense lawyers claimed to be shocked and promised to appeal. There was a photo of Patton French, a man in his mid-50s with a round face and waves of graying hair. As the story ran on, it became obvious that he had called up the paper with the breaking news and had been delighted to chat. It was a grueling trial. The actions of the defendants were reckless and greedy. The decision by the court was courageous and fair. Any appeal would be just another attempt to delay justice. He had won many trials, he boasted, but this was his biggest verdict. Quizzed about the recent spate of high awards, he downplayed any suggestion that the ruling was a bit outrageous. A jury in Hinds County handed out $500 million 2 years ago, he said. And in other parts of the state, enlightened juries were hitting greedy corporate defendants for $10 million here and $20 million there. This award is legally defensible on every front, he declared. His specialty, he said as the story wound down, was pharmaceutical liability.
He had 400 Ryax cases alone and was adding more each day. Ray did a word search for Ryax within the Sun Herald. 5 days after the story, on January 29th, there was a bold, full-page ad that began with the ominous question, "Have you taken Ryax?" Under it were two paragraphs of dire warnings about the dangers of the drug, then a paragraph detailing the recent victory of Patton French, expert trial attorney specializing in Ryax and other problematic drugs. A victim screening session would take place at a Gulfport hotel for the following 10 days with qualified medical experts conducting the tests. The screening was at no cost to those who responded. No strings attached, or at least none were mentioned. In clear letters across the bottom of the page was the information that the ad was paid for by the law firm of French and French, with addresses and phone numbers of their offices in Gulfport, Biloxi, and Pascagoula. The word search produced an almost identical ad dated March 1, 1999. The only difference was the time and place of the screening. Another ad ran in the Sunday edition of the Sun Herald on May 2, 1999. For almost an hour, Ray ventured out from the coast and found the same ads in the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, the Hattiesburg American, the Mobile Register, the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, and the Advocate in Baton Rouge. Patton French had launched a massive frontal assault on Ryax and Meyer Brack. Convinced that the newspaper ads could spread to all 50 states, Ray grew weary of it. On a guess, he did a web search for Mr. French and was welcomed to the firm's own site, a very impressive piece of propaganda. There were now 14 lawyers in the firm, with offices in 6 cities and expanding by the hour. Patton French had a flattering 1-page biography that would have embarrassed those with thinner skins. His father, the elder French, looked to be 80 if a day, and had taken senior status, whatever that meant. The firm's thrust was its rabid representation of folks injured by bad drugs and bad doctors. It had brilliantly negotiated the largest Ryax settlement to date, $900 million for 7,200 clients. Now it was hammering Shine Medical, makers of Minitrin, the widely used and obscenely profitable hypertension drug that the FDA had pulled because of its side effects. The firm had almost 2,000 Minitrin clients and was screening more each week. Patton French had hit Clark Pharmaceuticals for an $8 million jury verdict in New Orleans. The drug it wore there was Cobril, an antidepressant that had been loosely linked to hearing loss. The firm had settled its first batch of Cobril cases, 1,400 of them, for $52 million. Little was said about the other members of the firm, giving the clear impression that it was a one-man show, with a squad of minions in the back rooms grappling with thousands of clients who had been gathered up on the street. There was a page with Mr. French's speaking engagements, one with his extensive trial calendar, and 2 pages of screening schedules covering no less than 8 drugs, including Skinny Benz, the fat pill Forrest had mentioned earlier. To better serve its clients, the French firm had purchased a Gulfstream 4, and there was a large color photo of it on the ramp somewhere, with, of course, Patton French posed near the nose in a dark designer suit with a fierce smile, ready to hop on board and go fight for justice somewhere. Ray knew that such a plane probably cost about $30 million, with 2 full-time pilots and a list of maintenance expenses that would terrify an accountant. Patton French was a shameless ego pit. The airplane was the final straw, and Ray left the library. Leaning on his car, he dialed the number for French and French and worked his way through the recorded menu. Client, lawyer, judge, other, screening information, paralegals, the first 4 letters of your lawyer's last name. 3 secretaries working diligently for Mr. French passed him along until he came to the one in charge of scheduling. Exhausted, Ray said, "I really would like to see Mr. French." "He's out of town," she said, surprisingly polite. Of course he was out of town. Okay, listen, Ray said rudely. I'm only doing this one time. My name is Ray Attlee. My father was Judge Reuben Attlee. I'm here in Biloxi, and I'd like to see Patton French. He gave her his cell phone number and drove away. He went to the Acropolis, a tacky Vegas-style casino with a Greek theme, badly done, but absolutely no one cared. The parking lot was busy, and there were security guards on duty. Whether they were watching anything was uncertain. He found a bar with a view of the floor and was sipping a soda when his cell phone beeped.
"Mr. Ray Attlee," said the voice.
"That's me," Ray said, pressing the phone closer.
"Patton French here. Delighted you called. Sorry I wasn't in."
"I'm sure you're a busy man."
"Indeed I am. You're on the coast?"
"Right now I'm sitting in the Acropolis, a wonderful place."
"Well, I'm headed back. Been down to Naples for a plaintiff's counsel meeting with some big Florida lawyers."
Here we go, thought Ray.
"Very sorry about your father," French said, and the signal cracked just a little.
Probably at 40,000 feet, streaking home.
"Thank you," Ray said. "I was at the funeral, saw you there, but didn't get a chance to speak. A lovely man, the judge."
"Thank you," Ray said again.
"How's Forrest?"
"How do you know Forrest?"
"I know almost everything, Ray. My pretrial preparation is meticulous. We gather information by the truckload. That's how we win. Anyway, is he clean these days?"
"As far as I know," Ray said, irritated that a private matter would be brought up as casually as the weather. But he knew from the website that the man had no finesse.
"Good. Look, I'll be in sometime tomorrow. I'm on my yacht, so the pace is a bit slower. Can we do lunch or dinner?"
"Didn't see a yacht on the webpage, Mr. French. Must have been an oversight." Ray preferred 1 hour over coffee, as opposed to a 2 hour lunch or an even longer dinner, but he was the guest.
"Either one. Keep them both open, if you don't mind. We're hitting some wind here in the Gulf, and I'm not sure when I'll be in. Can I have my girl call you tomorrow?"
"Sure."
"Are we discussing the Gibson trial?"
"Yes, unless it's something else."
"No, it all started with Gibson."
Back at the Easy Sleep Inn, Ray half watched a muted baseball game and tried to read while waiting for the sun to disappear. He needed sleep, but was unwilling to tuck in before dark. He got Forrest on the second try, and they were discussing the joys of rehab when the cell phone erupted.
"I'll call you back," Ray said and hung up.
An intruder was in his apartment again. "A burglary in progress," said the robotic voice from the alarm company. When the recording went dead, Ray opened the door and stared at his car less than 20 feet away. He held the cell phone and waited. The alarm company also called Corey Crawford, who called 15 minutes later with the same report. Crowbar through the door on the street, crowbar through the door to the apartment, a table knocked over, lights on, all appliances accounted for. The same policeman filing the same report.
"There's nothing valuable there," Ray said. "Then why do they keep breaking in?" Corey asked.
"I don't know." Crawford called the landlord, who promised to find a carpenter and patch up the doors. After the cop left, Corey waited in the apartment and called Ray again.
"This is not a coincidence," he said.
"Why not?" Ray asked.
"They're not trying to steal anything. It's intimidation, that's all. What's going on?"
"I don't know."
"I think you do."
"I swear."
"I think you're not telling me everything."
You're certainly right about that, Ray thought. But he held his ground. "It's random, Corey. Relax. Just some of those downtown kids with pink hair and spikes through their jaws. They're druggies looking for a quick buck."
"I know the area. These aren't kids."
"A pro wouldn't return if he knew about the alarm. It's two different people."
"I disagree."
They agreed to disagree, though both knew the truth. He rolled in the darkness for 2 hours, unable even to close his eyes. Around 11, he went for a drive and found himself back at the Acropolis, where he played roulette and drank bad wine until 2 in the morning. He asked for a room overlooking the parking lot, not the beach, and from a third-floor window, he guarded his car until he fell asleep. Chapter 30. He slept until housekeeping got tired of waiting. Checkout was noon, no exceptions. And when the maid banged on the door at 11:45, he yelled something through the door and jumped in the shower. His car looked fine, no pry marks or dents or scrapes around the rear. He unlocked the trunk and quickly peered inside. 3 black plastic garbage bags stuffed with money. All was normal until he got behind the wheel and saw an envelope tucked under the windshield wiper in front of him. He froze and stared at it, and it seemed to stare back at him from 30 inches away. Plain white, legal size, no visible markings, at least on the side touching the glass. Whatever it was, it couldn't be good. It wasn't a flyer for a pizza delivery, or some clown running for office. It wasn't a ticket for expired parking, because parking was free at the Acropolis Casino. It was an envelope, with something in it. He slowly crawled out of the car, and looked around on the chance he'd spot someone out there. He lifted the wiper, took the envelope, and examined it as if it might be crucial evidence in a murder trial. Then he got back in the car, because he figured someone was watching. Inside was another trifold, another color digital picture printed off the computer, this one of Unit 37F at Cheney's self-storage in Charlottesville, Virginia, 930 miles and at least 18 hours away by car. Same camera, same printer. No doubt the same photographer who no doubt knew that 37F was not the last unit Ray had used to hide the money. Though he was too numb to move, Ray drove away in a hurry. He sped along Highway 90, watching everything behind him, then suddenly veered to the left and turned onto a street that he followed north for a mile until he abruptly pulled into the parking lot of a laundromat. No one was following. For an hour he watched every car and saw nothing suspicious. For comfort, his pistol was next to his seat, ready for action. And even more comforting was the money sitting just inches away. He had everything he needed. The call from Mr. French's scheduling secretary came at 11:15. Crucial matters had conspired to make lunch impossible, but an early dinner would be his pleasure. She asked if Ray would come to the great man's office around 4 p.m., and the evening would proceed from there. The office, a flattering photo of which appeared on the website, was a stately Georgian home overlooking the Gulf, on a long lot shaded with oaks and Spanish moss. Its neighbors were of similar architecture and age. The rear had recently been converted into a parking lot with tall brick walls around it, and security cameras scanning back and forth. A metal gate was opened for Ray, and closed behind him by a guard dressed like a Secret Service agent. He parked in a reserved place, and another guard escorted him up to the rear of the building, where a crew was busy laying tile while another planted shrubs. A major renovation of the office and premises was rapidly winding down.
"The governor's coming in 3 days," the guard whispered.
"Wow," Ray said. French's personal office was on the second floor, but he was not in it. He was still on his yacht, out in the Gulf, explained a comely young brunette in a tight, expensive dress. She led him into Mr. French's office anyway, and asked him to wait in a sitting area by the windows. The room was paneled in blonde oak and held enough heavy leather sofas, chairs, and ottomans to furnish a hunting lodge. The desk was the size of a swimming pool and covered with scale models of great yachts. "He likes boats, huh?" Ray said, looking around. He was expected to be impressed.
"Yes, he does."
With a remote, she opened a cabinet and a large flat screen slid out.
"He's in a meeting," she said, "but he'll be on in just a moment. Would you like a drink?"
"Thanks, black coffee." There was a tiny camera in the top right corner of the screen, and Ray assumed he and Mr. French were about to chat via satellite. His irritation at waiting was slowly building. Normally it would have been boiling by now, but he was captivated by the show that was unfolding around him. He was a character in it. Relax and enjoy it, he told himself. You have plenty of time. She returned with the coffee, which of course was served in fine china, F&F engraved on the side of the cup. "Can I step outside?" Ray asked.
"Certainly." She smiled and returned to her desk.
There was a long balcony through a set of doors. Ray sipped his coffee at the railing and admired the view. The wide front lawn ended at the highway, and beyond it was the beach and the water. No casinos were visible, not much in the way of development. Below him on the front porch, some painters were chattering back and forth as they moved their ladders. Everything about the place looked and felt new. Patton French had just won the lottery.
"Mr. Attlee," she called, and Ray stepped inside the office.
On the screen was the face of Patton French, hair slightly disheveled, reading glasses perched on his nose, eyes frowning above them.
"There you are," he barked. "Sorry for the delay. Have a seat there, if you will, Ray, so I can see you."
She pointed, and Ray sat.
"How are you?" French asked.
"Fine. You?"
"Great. Look, sorry for the mix-up. All my fault. But I've been on one of these damn conference calls all afternoon. Just couldn't get away. I was thinking it would be a lot quieter here on the boat for dinner. What do you think? My chef's a damn sight better than anything you'll find on land. I'm only 30 minutes out. We'll have a drink, just the two of us, then a long dinner, and we'll talk about your father. It'll be enjoyable, I promise."
When he finally shut up, Ray said, "Will my car be secure here?"
"Of course. Hell, it's in a compound. I'll tell the guards to sit on the damn thing if you want."
"Okay. Do I swim out?"
"No, I've got boats. Dickie'll bring you."
Dickie was the same thick young man who had escorted Ray into the building. Now he escorted him out, where a very long silver Mercedes was waiting. Dickie drove it like a tank through the traffic to the Point Cadet Marina, where 100 small vessels were docked. One of the larger ones just happened to be owned by Patton French. Its name was the Lady of Justice.
"The water's smooth. Take about 25 minutes, Dickie said, as they climbed on board.
The engines were running. A steward with a thick accent asked Ray if he'd like a drink.
"Diet soda," he said.
They cast off and puttered through the rows of slips and past the marina until they were away from the pier. Ray climbed to the upper deck and watched the shoreline fade into the distance. Anchored 10 miles from Biloxi was the King of Torts, a 140-foot luxury yacht with a crew of 5 and plush quarters for 12 friends. The only passenger was Mr. French, and he was waiting to greet his dinner guest.
"A real pleasure, Ray," he said as he pumped his hand and then squeezed his shoulder.
"A pleasure for me as well," Ray said, holding his ground because French liked close contact.
He was an inch or two taller, with a nicely tanned face, fierce blue eyes that squinted and did not blink.
"I'm so glad you came," French said, squeezing Ray's hand.
Fraternity brothers couldn't have pawed each other with more affection.
"Stay here, Dickie," he barked to the deck below.
"Follow me, Ray," he said, and they were off, up one short flight to the main deck, where a steward in a white jacket was waiting with a starched F&F towel folded perfectly over his arm.
"What'll you have?" he demanded of Ray.
Suspecting that French was not a man who toyed with light booze, Ray said,
"What's especially of the house?"
"Iced vodka with a twist of lime."
"I'll try it," Ray said.
"It's a great new vodka from Norway. You'll love it."
The man knew his vodkas. He was wearing a black linen shirt buttoned at the neck, and tan linen shorts perfectly pressed and hanging nicely on his frame. There was a slight belly, but he was thick through the chest, and his forearms were twice the normal size. He liked his hair because he couldn't keep his hands out of it.
"How about the boat?"
he asked, waving his hands from stern to bow.
"It was built by a Saudi prince, one of the lesser ones, a couple of years ago. Dumbass put a fireplace in it. Can you believe that? Cost him $20 million or so, and after a year he traded it in for a 200-footer.
"It's amazing," Ray said, trying to sound sufficiently awed. The world of yachting was one he had never been near, and he suspected that after this episode, he would forever keep his distance.
"Built by the Italians,"
French said, tapping a railing made of some terribly expensive wood.
"Why do you stay out here in the Gulf?" Ray asked.
"I'm an offshore kind of guy, if you know what I mean. Sit."
For
French pointed and they lowered themselves into two long deck chairs. When they were nestled in, French nodded to the shore.
You can barely see Biloxi, and this is close enough. I can do more work out here in one day than in a week at the office. Plus, I'm transitioning from one house to the next. A divorce is in the works. This is where I hide.
Sorry.
This is the biggest yacht in Biloxi now, and most folks can spot it. The current wife thinks I've sold it, and if I get too close to the shore, then her slimy little lawyer might swim out and take a picture of it. 10 miles is close enough.
The iced vodkas arrived in tall, narrow glasses, F&F engraved on the sides. Ray took a sip and the concoction burned all the way to his toes. French took a long pull and smacked his lips.
What do you think? He asked proudly.
Nice vodka, Ray said. He couldn't remember the last time he'd had one.
Dickie brought fresh swordfish out for dinner. Sound okay?
Great.
And the oysters are good now.
I went to law school at Tulane. I had 3 years of fresh oysters.
I know,
French said, and pulled a small radio from his shirt pocket and passed along their dinner selections to someone below. He glanced at his watch and decided they would eat in 2 hours.
You went to school with Hassel Mangrum, French said.
Yes, he was a year ahead of me.
We share the same trainer. Hassel has done well here on the coast. Got in early with the asbestos boys.
I haven't heard from Hassel in 20 years.
You haven't missed much. He's a jerk now. I suspect he was a jerk in law school.
He was. How'd you know I went to school with Mangrum?
Research, Ray. Extensive research.
He swigged the vodka again. Ray's third sip went straight to his brain.
We spent a bunch of dough investigating Judge Attlee, and his family, and his background, his rulings, his finances, everything we could find. Nothing illegal or intrusive, mind you, but old-fashioned detective work. We knew about your divorce. What's his name? Lou the Liquidator?
Ray just nodded. He wanted to say something derogatory about Lou Radowski, and he wanted to rebuke French for digging through his past. But for a second, the vodka was blocking signals. So he nodded.
We knew your salary as a law professor. It's public record in Virginia, you know.
Yes, it is.
Not a bad salary, Ray. But then it's a great law school.
It is indeed.
Digging through your brother's past was quite an adventure.
I'm sure it was. It's been an adventure for the family.
We read every ruling your father issued in damage suits and wrongful death cases. There weren't many, but we picked up clues. He was conservative with his awards, but he also favored the little guy, the working man. We knew he would follow the law, but we also knew that old chancellors often mold the law to fit their notion of fairness. I had clerks doing the grunt work, but I read every one of his important decisions. He was a brilliant man, Ray, and always fair. I never disagreed with one of his opinions.
You picked my father for the Gibson case.
Yes. When we made the decision to file the case in Chancery Court and try it without a jury, we also decided we did not want a local chancellor to hear it. We have three. One is related to the Gibson family. One refuses to hear any matter other than divorces. One is 84, senile, and hasn't left the house in 3 years. So we looked around the state and found